You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanders,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Casey Frieda.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a fantastic show for you today. But before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about a couple of sponsors who make the show possible each and every day. Craig Allinson has a brand new book. It's a spinoff of the Expeditionary Force series, Expeditionary Force Mavericks Book 1, Death Trap. The human soldiers stranded on the planet Paradise have been recruited into an alien legion to do the dirty jobs that the high-tech species won't do. Their first mission is to kick the enemy off a backwater planet no one cares about. It's a simple assignment, except everyone has a hidden agenda, and the planet could become a death trap. Craig Allinson's brand new book, Death Trap. Also thanks to Ernie Lindsay with his Sarah series, the psychological thriller series that begins with Sarah, has books 1-3 and a bonus novella, Single Mother, Successful Executive, Target for Revenge. The psychological thriller series box set, Sarah Winthrop's world is thrown headlong into a whirlwind of chaos along with her family, friends, and colleagues by unseen enemies seeking revenge. Those lurking in the shadows clawing for vengeance will go to any lengths. Any lengths. It's likely never occurred to them that they may have just messed with the wrong woman. The Sarah series. Books 1-3 and a bonus novella by Ernie Lindsay. Also, John L. Monk with The Jenkins Cycle. From Book 1, Kick, a supernatural thriller. They say suicides are damned for eternity, but if possessing the bodies of violent criminals is hell, then Dan Jenkins will take it. And he does. Every time a portal arrives to whisk him from his ghostly exile. Normally, before the villain returns to kick him out, Dan dishes out a final serving of justice and leaves the world a safer place. It's one of the rules if he wants more rides, and he's happy to oblige. For a part-time dead guy, it's a pretty good gig. And then he meets her. Kick is the first book in a series of supernatural thrillers. If you like Quantum Leap and Every Day, you'll love this gritty and original take on the body-hopping hero story. Vividly written, Kick is a wild ride with a sharp, sarcastic wit and a flawed, yet likable main character. From John L. Monk, The Jenkins Cycle, Book 1, Kick. And from M.D. Massey, Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. The action-packed first novel in M.D. Massey's Them Zombie Apocalypse series. When a surprise nuclear attack forces Aiden from hiding, he finds the world to be a much different place and more deadly. Now he'll traverse a post-apocalyptic landscape populated by violent redneck looters, rogue military factions, and an army of hungry undead. After two combat tours in the Middle East, Aiden Sullivan just wants to be left alone on his family's ranch in the Texas Hill Country. But when the bombs fall and the dead walk, Aiden risks life and limb to rescue his aging parents from the zombie horde. To save them, he'll traverse half the state of Texas while fighting rogue military units, violent redneck looters, and thousands of walking dead. The question is, can he make it there in time? Only one thing's for sure, this ranger will complete the mission or he'll die trying. M.D. Massey's Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. Now on to our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Andre Frieden on the show with me today. He has a brand new book called The Pyongyang Option that is out everywhere now when you're hearing this. Andre writes under the name A.C. Frieden, and he has quite a few books out already, and I think we're going to have a great time talking today. Welcome to the show, Andre.
My pleasure. I'm delighted to be on your show and look forward to chatting with you. Yeah.
Well, Andre, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, I grew up overseas and English was always a challenge in the early years, because I was in French schools up until the age of eight. So for me, writing was a challenge because I wanted to write and speak English as well as any other native English speaker. So that sort of drew me to, you know, write as well as I could. And then also because I lived abroad, I spent a lot of time in different cultures. I lived in five countries before moving to the US. So with all these travels, it sort of drew me to how do I, you know, make sense of it? How can I draw all these experiences into something of use? So I think over time, the writing and the storytelling was just sort of a natural fit to put it all together.
What's were you a big reader as a kid?
I was, but mostly for nonfiction. I didn't read so much fiction, except what was required in school. So, you know, I was more, I would say on the artistic side, I was more influenced by movies, thrillers, mysteries, that sort of, influenced me more.
Did you grow up in a bookish family?
Not really. In fact, I think nobody really had time to read a lot. We moved every 3 years. My parents were very busy, and I always felt that I was uprooted and brought to a new culture, a new country, and had to build everything from scratch, whether it was friendships or understanding the culture. So in some ways, it's sort of living a distracted life where you didn't have the tranquility really to read and sit back and delve into the literary arts.
What do you think the turning point for you was? Like me, I had a difficult time reading as a youngster because I had dyslexia, and I found ways to work around that. But there were a couple of books that really unlocked it for me. What was the turning point for you?
I think the turning point for me was in my early college years. I think it was my freshman year. I had a professor of creative writing, and I took the class just to fill in the credit hours. I really wasn't so interested in the course, but towards the end of the year, we wrote a short story, and to my surprise, he not only liked it, he really discussed it with me in great detail and wanted to push me to expand on it, to write to turn it into a more lengthy fiction in the future. And that sort of opened my eyes to, wow, maybe I can write well. You know, maybe there's something in this story that I can make a career out of. Because I was still very much on track on the professional side to focus on becoming a lawyer. So that was, in some ways I looked at writing as potentially a distraction from my career goals. But ultimately I found a way to do both.
Now, along the way, you served in the Swiss Army, didn't you?
I did. Now keep in mind that all fit males have to serve in the Swiss Army. There's still a draft. While most countries in Europe now have no longer have that requirement, Switzerland is one of the few that still have it. But because I lived overseas, you get exempted. But I wasn't going to be the odd one out. My father did it. My grandfather did it. All my friends did it. I could just hear it if I found a way to not serve. So I went back and I trained as a marksman in a mechanized infantry unit.
Wow. Now, the books that you write are international thrillers with these big set pieces and lots of moving parts and, you know, geopolitical fallout, because you did have such an interesting childhood, moving around, exposed to, lots of different cultures and kind of seeing, you know, one problem that we have, if you spend, and I guess this happens with any country, if you spend your entire life there, is you see everything from only that point of view. Do you feel like moving around so much and being exposed to so many different places and people helped you to kind of hone the way you write and the way that you tell the stories that you do now?
Yeah, I think from a 50,000 foot level, I think what living in different countries has done is to look at good and evil in sort of a different light, that no one has clean hands. Everyone has a little bit of guilt, whether it's a country, an organization, or characters. And I put that in my books so that I don't follow stereotypical plots where there's always one good country or one good group of people. The guilt, the villains are spread equally. So I think that's sort of the perspective that I bring through my upbringing, is that good and evil are just labels, and when you dig deeper, it's really hard to find in which camp anyone really sits.
Right. So what was the idea for the first book that you tried? You had this experience in college and kind of opened you up, but then how does that translate to writing one of the big epic stories that you do?
Yeah, so my first novel was a standalone, and it was called Canvas Sunsets Never Fade. And it was my first try, really, at an espionage mystery. It wasn't so much a thriller, but much more of a mystery. And it introduced me to, you know, plotting, to understand and develop characters. I thought it was just a very good training ground for me to then delve into the beginnings of a series, which is now with the Pyongyang Option, that's number 3 in the Jonathan Brooks series. So I think I really enjoyed it. It took a long time to write that first book because I had started law school. I put it aside and picked it back up right after law school, you know, trying to carve some time out of a weekly schedule. And especially when you're right out of law school working on a law firm, you're, you know, easily working 70-hour weeks. So it's a struggle, you know, but I did it, and it was a very good training for me. And now I feel that this Jonathan Brooks series now is much more mature. Every book I feel that I'm learning more, writing better, have developed better, stronger relationships with my editor. So it's progress. I look at it that way.
When, you know, taking on a book, and especially as complicated and complex as the books are that you write, that could feel like a lot of work for some people. But when you're juggling that with law school and then, you know, eventually a law career, do you view writing as kind of an escape for that? Does it allow you to flex different muscles and escape the reality of thing into these stories?
It is, and I have several lawyer colleagues who also write fiction, and it's not uncommon. It's partly an escape. It's partly a love of writing, but you're writing it for a different purpose and a different style. And it's still, I think, one of the traits of most lawyers. It's in their DNA is to have an attention to detail. And when you have complex plots, you have to pay attention to the minutiae, because there's always a reader out there who will find a fault, whether it's a fault with a character, a scene, or the plot in general. So you have to be thorough. And my research is what I delve in deeply before I even start writing.
So let's talk about that. When your books are intricately plotted, so I'm assuming you are a pre-plotter. Do you work out the story and the kind of the major set points and pieces before you start writing?
Well, it's kind of I've changed for every book, but I would say that the last two books, I start in a perhaps a strange way. I decide what I want to leave the reader with at the end of the book. When they turn those last few pages of the story, what feeling do I want that reader to walk away with? Not just the result after the climax and the ending of the story, but really what do I want the reader to walk away with? So I started the last two books, including The Pyongyang Option, writing the last chapter. And that sort of sets the beacon as I write the rest of the story. And, of course, it's going to change a little bit by the time you reach the end, but I would say the last chapter, the last two chapters in The Pyongyang Option are probably 50 or 60% intact from the first draft of those chapters. So I stayed pretty much on course with what I wanted. But and the first half of the book was extremely organized, well outlined and so forth. But I had only a very vague idea of how the second half of the book was going to turn out. I knew the ending, but that, you know, the bulk of that second half of the book, I didn't preconceive, and it took a lot of work when I reached that point, the midway point of the story, to make it shift properly.
That's really intense. I usually know the ending of a book, and I usually have a good feel for that last scene and the emotional impact of it and kind of the wrap up. But I've never written that last chapter first. But that sounds like a fun tool to use to really go ahead and nail that final emotional payoff.
Yeah, I mean, it ends up just being a beacon, and you try to stay on course. The main challenge with this book is that the first half essentially takes place in Ukraine and the second half in North Korea. So the tricky part was really to find the proper believable link that would shift the story to North Korea. And North Korea is not just a country that you can just hop on a plane and visit. So it had to be an intricate way and logical way that the story would flow to North Korea. But I tried to take as much as I could from my visit both to Ukraine and to North Korea, my experiences there, and bring them into the story.
When a story starts hatching for you and starts coming together, and you realize, okay, this is a narrative that I think I can tell. How do you start gathering research? I know that you do a lot of on-site research and visiting places. How do you start gathering information that you may or may not use in the story?
Mm-hmm. So, before I start traveling, I find contacts, and I'm always pleasantly surprised at how much people are willing to help, whether it's to sit down and be interviewed, or link you up with other contacts. So I've been very lucky in my writing career to have, you know, a host of contacts that have been extremely helpful. So and where I can't find these contacts, I will hire consultants to help me. I will go on paid tours. I will pay other facilitators in order to get that access that I need. In this particular book, unlike the others in the Jonathan Brooks series, it's a little bit harder to travel with this book, to go to the places that are featured here. In the prior books, it takes place, The Serpent's Game, which is the book prior to this, takes place in Central America mostly, and Tranquility Denied, in the Nordic countries and in Russia. But, North Korea now, as I understand it, Americans are no longer permitted to travel to North Korea. And Ukraine is accessible, of course, but part of the country is going through a civil war. And Chernobyl is not necessarily an ideal place to visit for health reasons, but I took 3 hours there. So.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that at the end, because when you're writing books, that are dealing with places that that we read about in the news, and we see, you know, turmoil and upset, you know, all the time. Have you ever had a situation where you're telling a story in a place and then real life events conspire against you, or politics change and things like that, and you have to say, oh, well, maybe I need to rethink the storyline?
Mm-hmm. Well, it happened exactly in the Pyongyang option. When I visited Pyongyang, it was at the time that Kim Jong-il was the leader, so the father of the current leader, Kim Jong-un. So I thought I was going to write this story faster. But I didn't. It just took a lot longer, and I was still working on the previous book. So as we started to get into editing, and there were still probably 30 or 40% of the book unwritten, I struggled to, how can you make this book, which is set actually in 2005. How do we make it contemporary? How can I bring it to the realities of the U.S. North Korea tensions that exist today, the hacking, the espionage, the political gamesmanship? So, my editor and I sat and we thought and we thought and we thought, and we came up with a terrific idea. And I can't give a spoiler here, but there is something that happens in the story that will surprise probably every reader. And it does attach it to today. So it was a rescue for the story, essentially. And it worked out really well. But because so much time had elapsed and the leader died from the time that I visited, it was a challenge, but we faced it, and I think we've done it well.
Nice. Your main protagonist in this series, Jonathan Brooks. Tell us about Jonathan. Where did he come from for you, and what makes him who he is?
One of the things that I try to do in this character and in all the stories is I portray Jonathan as an ordinary lawyer. He wants to just live his life and practice as a maritime lawyer based in New Orleans. But he's constantly challenged and thrown into extraordinary circumstances that end up being more espionage and political events. And there's a little bit of legal drama, but these are not legal thrillers, although he's a lawyer. So I want to make him as human as possible, as normal as possible. He's just a very good improviser. He thinks well and he can adapt, and does really extraordinary things. But he has a lot in common with most readers. He believes in law and justice and that the good should prevail and fairness. But the circumstances that he runs into or he's thrown into really test his limits.
You set the books in New Orleans. Jonathan is a lawyer in New Orleans. What made you pick that city?
Well, I went to law school in New Orleans
at
Loyola.
Okay.
And had just an amazing experience. I think New Orleans is just one of these unusual American cities that bring you just a wide spectrum of experiences. And I think it's just a very rich environment for a character to be based. And also enough things have happened in New Orleans that from a crime fiction standpoint that you're able to capture a reader's interest. As an example, The Serpent's Game, the book prior to the Pyongyang option, the story begins 2 days before Hurricane Katrina strikes the city. So Jonathan goes through this tumultuous experience of the hurricane while an espionage story takes place at the same time. So New Orleans, it's a great city, a great culture, and its history all sort of line up to create and strengthen this character.
You also have another series that you're working on, aren't you? Other than Jonathan Brooks?
I have, but it's not fully developed and it's not completely announced yet, but it's a novella series. It's a novella trilogy. And it's an experiment into deviating into more the military fiction market. So that's something, that's a side project that that I'm interested in, and I will pursue it probably after the next two titles in the Jonathan Brooks series come out. So the next two, Letter from Istanbul, comes out at the end of this year, and Midnight in Delhi comes out around this time next year. And that follows from my multiple trips to India in the last 4 years. I've gone 17, 18 times for my legal work, and it's about time that I bring India into my novels.
Nice. When you start thinking about a new book, does it usually come out of travel somewhere? How does a story begin for you? Is it something you observe? Is it an idea for a situation to put a character in? Maybe Jonathan, or how does that creative process begin for you?
I think in almost everything I do, whether it's here in the U.S. or during my travels, I have one eye set on what I can use for my novels. So I think settings, especially international settings, in the course of my work or my personal travel, is sort of the stimulus for a story. And then I start, you know, building a plot around it and how the characters would fit. But I think the very first ingredient is where I am in a strange or bizarre or dangerous place. And that sort of triggers my interest to turn it into a story.
Nice. This is the fourth book in the Jonathan series, the Jonathan Brooks series. Are there any challenges that come as you're writing a character for so long and keep continuing his story while keeping the stakes high?
Yeah, I mean, this is only the third book in the series, The Pyongyang Option, and I think the character is still fresh and it's still being developed. I'm learning more about Jonathan Brooks as I write, and my editor and I always try to look at different aspects that a reader might want to make it even more real. And it's funny, as I think many fiction authors do when they interact with their editor, they talk about these characters, especially the protagonist, as if they are a real person. And so that I think is when you've achieved the right maturity in your character, is when you have a nearly fully developed person that you can discuss as if they are a real person. So I think there's still a lot of life left in Jonathan. He's now in his mid-40s. He's got a lot of energy. In each book, he's either at a low in his career or he's riding high. And that's when he starts facing the challenges of that environment in that particular story.
How long does it take you to write one of these books?
I'd like to go to a one a year. This one was more than 2 years behind schedule. And that is a, you know, direct consequence of my legal work. I started this novel in early 2015, right around the time that I changed jobs to be a corporate lawyer for a global tech company. And it just was an enormous amount of travel and work, and I wasn't able to really fit it in. But now I think that I found the right balance and the right timing and the right I've done all the research really for the next four or five books in terms of travel. So there's not an enormous amount of research left to do. It's more writing it. And I think now I can go back to a one a year schedule.
Well, what you're dealing with, I think a lot of writers have to deal with, and that's juggling, you know, a day job and real life with the fictional life that we get to live through our characters. Have you picked up any tools or skills that you can pass along to help people manage that, you know, a hectic schedule with making sure that you keep up with your creative life?
Mm-hmm. A couple of skills. One, I would say procrastination. I think I have mastered that quite well, and also being organized. So I think I'm an expert at both. Planning ahead is very difficult for me. I usually can't plan more than a week ahead. So a lot of it depends on how organized you are in the time you spend writing, the time you spend researching, and the time you spend collecting all that research and making sense of it.
Gotcha. Do you use any special software or anything to manage all the notes and all the research that you're collecting?
Word.
That has to be daunting to sort
it
through
is.
All that.
It is, but I use Word, I use Excel. A lot of my plot, my strategic thinking for the plots and the characters are done in corporate boardrooms where you've got, you know, three walls full of marker boards, and then I take pictures so I can retain all the information. And that starts off, you know, a more organized, you know, strategy for the story. Also the hardware that I use, I've got a monitor that you can have. It's a super wide screen, 30 inches wide. So I can have three documents open, at any one time on the same screen. And it's very easy to compare and jot notes and write at the same time. So there's some things that you can get that facilitate, but I would say organization is the most important.
And the fact that most of us walk around with a smartphone in our pocket all the time, you know, collecting snapshots and you know, saving notes that way by taking a picture is we kind of have it the best that anyone in history has had it as far as writers go, I would think.
True, and. Yeah. And that's probably my single most used tool is photography. And even for example, when I was in North Korea, you have in Pyongyang, you're followed by four people at all times. So these minders are, you know, constantly telling you what you can take pictures of and what you cannot. They're also clever enough to see when you're sneaking little pictures here and there. They'll come, they'll actually take your camera, find the picture and delete it. So then you know that you have to use two cameras at a time, to take sneaky pictures. One that they'll see the obvious large camera, but they don't see the other small one in your hand. And that I did when I was at the DMZ on the communist side. Because there are a lot of fortifications and things that were interesting to capture. So yes, photography is the number one tool that I use for research.
I love it. Well, now that everyone's hearing this, the Pyongyang option is out everywhere. What are you working on now?
Now, Letter from Istanbul, the next title in the series. I've been to Istanbul twice. The last time about a year and a half ago. It's a fascinating city, very rich environment for crime fiction. So it's a wonderful area. And I always try to find off the beaten path places, that have not been in movies, that have not been in other books, to the extent possible, so that I can bring something fresh to a reader.
Well, Istanbul is really a crossroad of cultures. I can only imagine what you're dreaming up for there. That city seems to be rich with possibilities.
It really is. And there's a new dimension to it now, because Turkey in many ways is both an ally and a potential adversary, perhaps. Maybe that's too strong of a word, for the U.S. So it's an interesting time now to explore that relationship and filter that into the story.
Well, I can't wait to see what you come up with for that, Andre. If people are just learning about you and want to find out more and dig into your back catalog and find out what's coming up, where can they connect with you at?
Well, I'm on Twitter at AC Frieden. My website is acfrieden.com. I post quite a bit about my travels and my research. I have a lot of infographics for each of the locations that I travel to with background information. So part of the fun of my books is also to understand how I research them. There are a lot of interesting pictures that I post. So I'm delighted to interact with readers. I think that's the most enjoyable part of being an author.
Absolutely. Well, Andre, we're going to put links to everything in the show notes and send everybody to see you. The Pyongyang option is out everywhere now. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thanks so much, Hank. A pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Seven men ran the farce, the seven witch hunters, the court of Oyer and Terminer. They tortured and lied and mutilated and murdered. They knew those women up in Salem Village were no witches. Their true target was the coven hidden in their own midst here in Salem Town. They meant to hang the innocent until the sisters surrendered. "Did they surrender?" said Jason. "No." Was that the wrong decision? To let innocent women die and save themselves? What do you think? Should the coven have fought openly? Created more hysteria by swooping in on broomsticks and casting spells over Salem? Should they have killed the judges? There are no right decisions. That is the horror of a witch hunt. Everything you do condemns you. Question the judge, thou art a defiant witch. Question his laws, you question the king, and thou art a treasonous witch. Question his superstitions, you question scripture, and thou art a blasphemous witch. Pity the condemned, you pity witches, and thy Christian mercy proves thy collusion with Satan. Witch hunters are not just bad lawyers practicing bad law. They are men who place the ends before the means. They choose their victim. A man, a woman, an entire race, and mark them for extinction. All evidence is damning evidence. All associations are damning associations. All infractions, and who among us is without sin, are unforgivable infractions. Their own failings and abuses of power are shrugged away as mere vigor in pursuit of the public good. A witch hunter will have you. By whatever means necessary. If he cannot find evidence, he will create evidence. He will entrap you and question you and distort what you say. He will walk you through the night until your feet bleed, strip you and stripe you, dress you in your own filth until you forget you are human. He will torture your friends until they betray you. And if anyone dares to weep at your hanging, he will drag them to Gallows Hill in the back of the next ox cart. Any man can be a witch hunter. All it takes is hatred and arrogance and the preening self-regard that proclaims, "My deeds are always good because they are my deeds." The seven judges of the Salem court were such men. But one witch stood up to them. She stood up to centuries of unchallenged, murderous dogma and pronounced the magic word, "No." They burned her for it.